starting the recording again. That's right. I'm
ski on for the
it's this, yes, for those of you on the, listening to the recording, if there are any such people, there's been a lot of complaints about the temperature today. Yes. So, just getting back to the content of the lecture and this idea of the being in itself, of this physical substrate, which science, yes. With science and scientists. I mean, I had a David Eagleman video that I played in this course before where I actually have a scientist on the BBC television saying, this is the really real, just so that I'm not just impugning people who really do say this. What's the really real is the electromagnetic radiation in the room. And what's not real is your experience of colour. It's not just the straw man. This is the genuine view of people, particularly people who are working on the brain, thinking about the brain and thinking about what does it mean? This neuroscientific knowledge that we're getting of the brain. So this being in itself is a substrate that lies below this subjective relative conscious experience that we have. And Husserl keeps on making this point, like at the bottom, but you see the visible measuring scales, the scale markings are used as actually existing things, not as illusions. Thus, that which actually exists in the life world as something valid, as a premise. There's a sort of a logical point being made there. You see, on one hand, we're saying that the world that science takes as the true and ultimate being in itself world of the physical, that's the kind of ground, if you like, of a scientific understanding of how reality is. It regards the subjective relative as something that it generates, and yet what the observations that are made in that subjective relative realm are the ground of science as well. You see, we've got two grounds here, because science finally, in order to construct its theories, it ultimately relies on the validity of the observations that it's making in this subjective relative world. And if it were to truly think that the subjective relative world was an illusion and had no truth in it whatsoever, then the entire truth of science would collapse with it, because the entire truth of science is based on observations made in this subjective relative world. So he's trying to point out, the whole thing's all crossed over in a quite an obvious way. This is the thing I always find surprising, is if you get involved in science and you start to observe the complexity and the extreme penetration of the thought that people are engaged in doing science, you wonder how such penetrating intelligence is able to ignore the bigger picture of the meaning of science itself. Because it's not through a lack of insight or intelligence, because the people working in my area, computer science, they're often, I'd be sitting there and you could feel that my brain's going like this, and they're going like that. I'm just seeing two steps ahead, they're 17 ahead. I see what you're going to say, and I've said it all, and, it's next, so it's not. It's strange. It's like the things that we're looking at are quite obvious if you bother to sit and look at them. And it's not that the people engaged in sciences are foolish or unintelligent, but it's to do with the assumptions that we hold in the background that we don't care to examine. That's what philosophy is, really. Philosophy doesn't require this extraordinary speed of intelligence. It requires a willingness to look into the background, into the assumptions that we hold. In a way, you almost have to slow down to be able to see those. So it's not that science doesn't... if I'm addressing now how scientists deal with the sort of questions that we're looking at, they deal with it as professionals do. They say, well, that's not my concern. What you're talking about is the concern of psychology. So let me hand you over to the psychology department, because you're in the physics department here. You know, we don't have to think about psychic phenomena, consciousness and all the rest of it. That's what the psychologists do. And so you walk down the corridor, you know, to the building where the psychologists live, and you discover that the psychologists themselves are constrained by the culture of science to have an objective understanding of what's going on. And we're talking about psychology as it once was. Psychology now is an extremely fragmented discipline. It's not that all psychology is objective. You know, Jungian and Freudian psychology is not objective in this sense. He would be talking in our culture of what would then have been behaviorism, which was an attempt to objectively understand the psyche. But behaviorism was again saying, we're going to study the psyche, but we're only going to study it objectively, which means that anything that you might say about having some kind of personal, private, inner experience, we're going to treat as just a claim you're making. Yes. And if we can find some objective evidence to back up that claim, then okay, we'll accept what you're saying is true in its way. And the way that that kind of psychology is progressing now is into brain scans. That's, brain scans are now the objectification of our experience. So you say that you're experiencing hunger. Okay, well, let's look at the brain scan. So you say that you're undergoing a trauma. Okay, let's look at the brain scan. And there's a psychology now, a kind of a neuropsychology that's developing, that's almost coming to a sort of an understanding that if we can relate what you're feeling, what you're saying, what you're experiencing, back to something that's occurring in the brain, then we've kind of explained it.
Yeah, that is true. Because yeah. The psychology books now have got a section on neuroscience. You know, they didn't have, like, when they were 10
years
ago or something.
Yeah, and further. There's a branch of psychology that's entirely engaged in trying to give an utterly objective explication of what appears to be in your psychic stream of experience, saying, well, the way we explain that is we relate it back to the physical causes, and that's psychology. And once we've got a kind of finished psychology would be something like this. It would be, we do a brain scan. We're in Star Trek now. You know, we remember Star Trek many years ago. You just had a scanner, a handheld thing. You just sort of, you scan the brain, you run it through your computer, and the computer reads out, this is what you're experiencing. Yeah. And the reason you're experiencing it is entirely explicable in terms of the connections and the firings and the behaviours of your nervous system. And if you want to change the way you're experiencing things, we just change the connections. And now we've understood this properly, we know how to change the connections. I mean, certain therapies that we do, CBT, for instance, we understand why it works now, because it's changed the connections of the neurons in certain ways. We understand what depression is now. It's a certain state that your brain gets into, and all we need to do to get rid of depression is to alter the brain, alter the connections of the brain. And our old psychological therapies were just very indirect ways of changing those connections. Now we've got a fully scientific psychology, we're actually going to reprogram your brain for you. You don't have to do anything, just come into this booth here. Yeah, and out you come. It's going to be like Brave New World. Out you come and you say, oh, I'm all right now. I'm okay now. I'll just go and get a job and a house, and I'll get married, and I'll have children. I don't know what it means, but I'll have a nice pension. All right, you get the story. The only thing I don't get, really, is why I have to die. In fact, I'll hand that back to the scientists, because I don't think I ought to die. Maybe I could upload my whole brain into a computer. You know, you get the story. That's a kind of a, sorry to anyone, if anyone's listening here who's actually involved in the field, that was a little bit of a simplification. But the gist of it is objective psychology finally is aimed at this, in this direction. So the physicist says, it's all right, I don't bother with psychology, because there are other professionals over here, and they more or less, I mean, that's what pharmacology is doing, isn't it? In terms of, you've got a depression, well, the problem is fixable by altering your brain chemistry. Yeah. Let's not think about the fact that we're living in a world that's utterly meaningless and utterly determined by science and a kind of an understanding that the true being in itself of you is the functioning of your physical brain. That maybe that might be depressing. That's just, you know, that doesn't enter into that picture. But there are, I mean, we have to say there are psychologies where that does enter into the picture. So it's not, we're not saying all of psychology is like that. But certainly what we would call scientific or objective psychology is engaged in this, what could be called a kind of reductionism. Because I've been in the area, I understand that there are a lot of people there who say, I'm not a reductionist. Because I recognise that the mental is not the same as the physical, but if you dig deep enough into what people are saying, they're still saying everything's determined by atoms, molecules, electrical, electrochemical charges, etc. So, the contrast, I'll just read the last one, the contrast between the subjectivity of the life world and the objective, the true world, but when he puts it in quotes, that means that's not true. The quotes mean the not true world. It's a shorthand for saying not. Lies in the fact that the latter is a theoretical, logical substruction. What a lovely phrase. Of something that is in principle not perceivable, in principle not experienceable in its own proper being, whereas the subjective in the life world is distinguished in all respects precisely by its being actually experientiable. I said that right that time, experientiable, not experienceable. The extraordinary thing about this mathematical, scientific, physical idea of reality is that there's a kind of a madness involved at a certain level. Insofar as we're engaged in that form of thinking, we take that which we cannot experience because it's inaccessible to us, to be more real than what we can experience, to be the truer reality. And again, I have to keep coming back to this. Why? Because we can explain our experience on the basis of this scientific, theoretical, logical substruction. Are you? I just feel like I need to make sure that you grasp this, because it doesn't look like a a theoretical, logical substruction when you learn your science, it looks like, because we always imagine what the science represents to be an atom or a molecule or a neuron or an electrical charge, we picture them intuitively in the language of our subjective relative conscious experience. But what the science, the world that science has really, the real substruction is an entirely mathematical entity.
Which in itself is not perceivable or experientiable.
Yes.
And that is the key contrast between needing to experience the world as is.
Yes, yes. So the cup for science is a kind of an illusion that we experience. Why is it an illusion? Because there's no such thing as colour. The surface is a kind of an illusion because if you get right up close to it, it's nearly all space. This is what we do in our imagination. If you were to become a conscious photon, yes, and you fired yourself at that cup, but the closer and closer you got to that cup, you'd actually just be travelling through space with other, you know, other things around you. Let's say you had some kind of vision as a photon. That's all you do, and as you hit that, you'll probably be drawn in to the orbit of a certain atom in there, and there'll be some kind of energy exchange, and some other kind of energy will be emitted out. But you'll never encounter a surface. A surface is something that we encounter because of our scale and our perceptual abilities, and you'll never encounter a coloured surface. You see, our entire experiential world is made up out of sensory qualities of things that, from a scientific perspective, are entirely relative to having eyes, having ears, having a body, to our being human. But the objective hasn't got anything to do with being human. That's what it means to be objective. And what is there in itself has become now for science a sort of deep mystery. Because there's, I don't know if you know, at the quantum level, which, and I'm not a quantum physicist, but the gist of it is that our idea of there being electrons and protons and photons as actual entities has sort of disappeared, in that these things only appear when there's some kind of event. And generally for physics, it means when they're observed in some way. If you don't observe the sort of physical reality, you don't make any observation. And the physicists aren't clear what making an observation means. I mean, at one level it means you actually, as a physicist, go in with some kind of instrument and actually measure it. But even then, it's not clear. There are physicists who think, but they're in a minority, that making an observation means that some consciousness registers it. But that's too scary, right, for physics. Do you see if there is no observation, then what's going on at the quantum level is that thing that you might call an electron is kind of spread out in multiple different states all at once. The sort of picture, if you like, is like this. If you were that only source of observation, and you turn your back on the world, it would all start going blurry. What? 'Cause as soon as you make an observation, you fix the world to be in a certain state. And it does remember that state. But if you stop observing it, then there are a whole bunch of possible states that it could be in starts to emerge out of that. And if it's not observed at all, they get further and further and further apart. And if you like, the possibility of the states of the universe multiply and multiply and multiply. And if you like, if you were to look at it, which you can't, and not make an observation, which you can't, it would be like the, it would be like it was all becoming blurred, as multiple states of the universe are all present all at once. And then when you make an observation, you turn around and suddenly it picks one.
One frame.
Yeah, picks one state. I mean, it's an amazing story. Yes.
So what's the difference between a substruction and a reduction?
So a substruction, Husserl's using that word to say that it's a foundation. When you reduce something, I mean, in a scientific reduction is something like you take something and you say it appears to be this, but it's really that.
So taking the mug for example again.
Yeah.
So the reduction of the mug would be the atoms which it constitutes the mug.
Well, it's a substruction, in the sense that what science is claiming is that our experience is generated out of that. A reduction would say, in a certain sense, our experience doesn't really exist. It's a kind of a pure materialism.
Yeah.
Is a reduction that even denies there's anything like consciousness. It just says, well, no, that's all there is. It's a kind of an incoherent, unthinkable situation, because it's trying to say that consciousness is an illusion and doesn't really exist. But anyone who's actually conscious can't coherently say that. You can't say that your immediate experience doesn't exist, because for you, you absolutely know it exists. That's what it means to be conscious.
Sorry.
Yes.
So, objective subjectivity, the theoretical, logical substruction. So what's theoretical? That the mug is there? The mug is theoretically there because it's obstructed on atoms, or is it that the atoms are theoretically there because there's a mug?
No. So the idea that there is an atom is a theory. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's and the whole of that world is theoretical, in the sense that according to our observations, we have induced or inferred that there must be structures like this that are causing what we observe. But they're theoretical,
yeah,
because we can't observe them directly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they're And they're logical, because we have simply hypothesized,
yeah,
that there are atoms, if you like. It's a theory that we have, the theory of the atom. But it's a logical theory, because we then deduce from the theory what the consequences are, purely logically. And if what we deduce from our theory is what we actually observe, then we conclude that our theory is correct, although there may still be a better theory. So the way that science progresses, in a way, is these are all theoretical constructs. This is where science says we're not a religion. We may come up with a better theory.
Yeah.
Yes. So and that's why somewhere here, I don't think we've got to it yet, It's regarded by science itself as an infinite task. It's like you're never going to arrive at what truly is, but your theories are going to get closer and closer, because your theories are going to account for more and more and more of what we actually experience. So is that?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to excuse myself. I just got over a cold, and it's a cold for me in here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you
want to
record?
I get it from my feet, and I even have like fur lying in my feet. I'm just, yeah.
You know, if you put your feet
like in front of the thing.
I mean, if it's going to be like that, you can sit on the. You can sit on the.
Yeah. No, okay. If, that's all right.
If you just spread your legs in front of the thing, it's.
Right, here we go. Here we go. Medical emergency.
Either put it on your knees or whichever way you want.
No, we weren't. We just weren't taking it seriously.
It's so cold.
It's so cold.
I'm going to carry on, Nicolette.
Yeah.
Yes. So, are we getting there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and at the, you know, at the very bottom of this now is stuff like string theory. It's so theoretical now that it's I read a book saying it's not even false because there's no possible observation that anyone could ever make to decide whether it's true or not. But the string theory that people are developing in physics has got to a point now where they're deciding on which string theory might be true on the basis of the mathematical harmony of the theory. Which is the more elegant theory? But don't ask me what I mean. In effect, I think it's proposing that there aren't particles. There are things called strings that exist in. You've got it.
They're not using it.
Right in front of Rekha. Come on, let's we're going to make her so hot.
Well, no, I sort of need to direct it over. That way.
This is Nicolette.
You guys warm enough over there?
Yeah. Are you all right at the end?
Yeah.
Because you haven't got the fire up there.
Yeah.
Okay, that is working.
See there. I want to make a joke about, you know,
you might get
difference of the climate between Greece and Germany. Greeks are much tougher, you know, because it's so cold. So cold in Greece, isn't it?
Well, anyway, that's cool. You can fiddle with it, but.
I am.
It gets too hot then.
Okay. So digging down this idea that finally what science is proposing is as being real, what you finally arrive at is a bunch of mathematical models, if you like.
So string theory is the idea that there aren't particles, but there are strings.
There aren't and the strings can manifest themselves as particles, but they don't exist in the spatio-temporal dimensionality that we experience. They're up to 11 dimensions now, so there are other dimensions of space and time within which these strings exist. But you see, it's already quantum physics is starting to leave behind what we could intuitively picture, and string theory has left it way behind. So I think the only people that could have any kind of possibility of, if you like, having any understanding of what it might mean would be the mathematicians themselves that are developing the theory. So we won't go into that. It's smelling a bit burning, actually.
Is that rain?
I think. The thing itself... Now, so we've got being in itself, right, which is this mathematical, logical, scientific model of the true being of the universe. And then we've got the thing itself, which is what is self-evidently given in perception.
Isn't something burning?
Yeah, so it's
the fire.
It's just the
fire.
It's the fire.
It's not
on fire yet.
Okay.
But it's
just making that smell. You know how those kind of
fires
make that smell?
Yeah, no, I can smell it quite more than you. but we think it's going to pass once it's heats up, burns off. It's the dust, I think. You know, the dust on the it'll go away. So this is important as the balancing. So we've been thinking like scientists for quite a while now, right? And this has come back to the immediate experience of the. I mean, I think about the cup, but the thing here is the best example is Alex or Nicolette, right? Or me, right? Each other. I know we're not really things, or we're things plus something else, but there's something in science here that's proposing something that's, if you look at it hard enough, is a bit mad. Because it's proposing that that your reality is the reality of a bunch of physical particles, and that my perception of you being there, your human body, the being that you are, isn't true. Whereas, if we put that to one side, thinking in that scientific manner, we don't even think that way. Is it true or isn't it true? We actually just experience it as being the case that there is a cup in front of me, and that's how it is. And do you see, if we hadn't had all of this scientific education, and you were to walk into a room where nobody had ever heard of mathematical science, and you were to try and persuade someone that isn't really present on the table, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for us to, the cup is in front of me as the cup that it is. Are you saying that some idea of there being atoms and molecules and some physical theoretical explanation of what that cup is the cup? Or is the cup in fact the very thing that I'm seeing now? Do you see it? Once again, you've got to kind of hold these two worlds, because do you see the way that we live moment to moment? We just do not doubt that the cup's there and that I'm seeing it. I do not doubt that John's sitting next to me. You do not doubt that I'm sitting here and talking to you. So in what way am I experiencing an illusion? Do you want me to go into that? So because there is a way here where you can start to take on the scientific view and start that it's some kind of illusion and start to destroy it, because both views can't be true. So I mean, just one of the things, if you like, is that science, a purely objective scientist would say, well, firstly, it's not really coloured. You know, your experience of the cup being coloured is a kind of an illusion. Would you allow me just to answer that? Okay. Even accepting science as science presents itself, the colour that I experience that to be is expressing something about the form of that cup. The way I like to think about this is, well, how else would you be able to make the form of the cup something you could experience? If you took the colour away, and I'm including black and white, then you've got no vision at all. Yes? So, do you see that you're God? You've got the task. I want to make it known unto you the form of this cup. How am I going to do it? I'm going, and God thinks for a little while and thinks, I need something that's going to be able to show that form to you in a three-dimensional, or if you include time, in a four-dimensional field. What shall I use? I'll use colour. That's how, if I have something like colour, then I can make the form of the cup into something knowable. Do you see that the idea that colour is subjective starts to disappear? Colour is neither subjective nor objective, actually. Colourism is a means of showing the form of something. And it actually conveys information about the surface. If we go back to science, it says, a certain kind of photonic energy is being reflected off that. I'm manifesting that to you by changing my quality. The surfaces are different, and I show you that the surfaces are different by differing colours. Do you see colours doing something? Colours expressing the forms of the things around you. And if you go into it and you say, but it's all space, I can come back as a physicist even and say, well, yes, that's true, but there's a certain rigidity to the atomic lattice of the cup that means that light doesn't pass through it and is reflected off it. And that's all part of physics. And you're experiencing the form of this cup is a completely true and accurate expression of the fact that the photonic energy in the room is being reflected off this particular thing here. Do you see? And I'm about to be saying now. And what's subjective about that? Do you see that if you go into the physics and you understand colour in a different way, you can say, no, well, the colour is actually directly expressing to us the objective form of the things around us. So what was all this talk about your stream of consciousness being some kind of an illusion? It arose out of a certain idea that colour doesn't exist when you look into the physical. So if you're an entirely objective scientist, you think that colour is an illusion because it doesn't exist, because it doesn't appear in your idea of the physical. And so you throw it into the subjective and you say it's something personal to you that just exists in your little stream of consciousness. But it isn't, is it? Because we all experience colour, don't we? Isn't the definition of objectivity that everybody has access to it? So, I don't know if this is making sense to you. That's a good phrase to use, isn't it? That the being of colour is something extraordinarily mysterious. If you think of what the physical is, it's not physical. If you think of your experience as being something entirely subjective and private to yourself, it's neither that either. It kind of, if there's a place that it belongs, a domain in which it belongs in the domain of the transcendental, doesn't it? It's transcendent of the physical.
I'll be getting to where Kant was.
Well, Kant didn't want to talk about colour, did he?
No, not specifically about colour, but he's saying that certain time and space are pre-given.
Yes.
And then we go on with that, seeing through it, to the life world and to science, without saying, well, where did this space and where did this
time come from? Yes. It's Kantian in a way. Mm. You see, there's all of this, which we've looked at already, there's all of this work going on, if you like, behind the scenes, that's presenting the world to us.
Yeah.
That in a way you can't say it's subjective, and you can't say it's objective.
Yeah.
because it's presenting what we consider to be the subject and the object all at once.
Yeah, they're all lying inside.
Yes. And colour itself doesn't belong in the subjective or the objective. It belongs in if you like, in the resource of that which is presenting everything. So, I'm in a way, I've destroyed the narrative, because it was like we were going on a certain narrative, and now I've sort of stepped out and said, well, there's a problem with this scientific view of subjectivity, which we keep bumping into. And yet, I don't know if you see this, a sort of a scientific understanding of things it's like a kind of a valley that you can get into. You can actually get into the valley and look at things scientifically, and it all makes sense. And you actually have to, by some kind of effort of consciousness, you have to say, hold on, I forgot. I forgot. It's a way of seeing things, right? But it's not ultimately true, because it doesn't contain, it doesn't acknowledge or include our being conscious in it. Let me read the last paragraph here, all right, maybe then. So the thing itself, because it's only in perception that we ever encounter the things themselves. This is one of the watchwords of phenomenology, to the things themselves. It's the recognition that everything that we think, all of our science, our whole understanding of what is finally grounded on our perceptual recognition of this world. Everything comes out of that, and everything leads back to that, except insofar as maybe there is some kind of, without, I'm talking about our living life here, and I'm leaving aside questions about, well, maybe there's a psyche that transcends that. Life beyond death, that's not our concern, at least not here.
Not in this room.
Not in this, yes. Yes, maybe it's further down the corridor. So let me just make sure you understand this. Every immediate cognition has the sense of an induction of something intuitable. Immediate cognition it means it's not immediate. So an immediate cognition is the cup. Immediate cognition is I picture the cup now with my eyes shut. Or I infer maybe that the cup is on the table, or I might have put it back in the kitchen, or I remember the cup that I was drinking of at home. These are all they're not immediate cognitions, but they refer to the thing itself. They're not just pure imagination of something that doesn't exist. And in referring to the thing itself, that means that there is a route back, in some way or other, back to some kind of immediate cognition.
Like realism. Realism as art, painting. A realist kind of painter. It's a kind of immediate.
Well, no, I mean the immediacy. Realism in painting means something else, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yes. So I'm leaving aside what's real here for the moment, and I'm just saying what's ultimately real. We're just leaving that aside, and we're saying how we actually live is that for us what is real is what we can perceive. And everything, if we're not perceiving something and we think that it's real, its reality rests in the fact that we can finally trace it back not to some scientific world, but we can trace it back to some possible immediate cognition. So when we remember something, even if we remember something that's now destroyed, like a cup that was crushed into tiny bits and scattered in the earth, we still consider it to have been something real because we once had an immediate perception of it. And other things that we take to be real, like a city in America that you've never visited. I don't know if you can think of one. I've never been to Albuquerque. But I take it to be real because I take it that I can catch a plane and go and visit it, and that I've also met other people who've had immediate experiences of Albuquerque, like Nicolette. Do you know, our sense of reality is not about some sense of there being an underlying layer of physical stuff. Our sense of reality is, if it's real, then it must be possible to have some kind of immediate cognition. We must be able to see some way to some cognition like that. And that's what it really means to us for something to be real. Even if we imagine something, we say that what we're imagining is unreal, but the fact we're imagining it is real. Do you see, our whole sense of reality is keyed back into our immediate experience, or the possibility of such experience. And all verification leads back to this. Now that's a repetition, really, including scientific verification. And this is what Husserl means by self-evidence. Do you know, the thing is, if you make a claim that something's true, you say, well, give me your evidence. And you might say, oh, well, I've got all these, you know, learned papers here, and all of these experts who say that it's true. And then you say, well, on what evidence do they base it? And you can keep tracing back evidence to evidence to evidence to evidence. Where does the evidence stop, that chain of evidence? You can't go on forever. It stops with my seeing the cup. Do you know? I don't go any further. You don't say, look, here's a cup. You don't say, well, where's your evidence? Do you see? That's the ultimate self-evidence. I mean, it's so simple. Yes? And Husserl's banging on about it, saying, and that's just how it is for the scientist. Finally, if the scientist says that there are atoms, and you say, what's your evidence? He or she will finally lead you back to some laboratory somewhere and will point to some kind of result of some experiment that will be appearing to you just like the cup. And at which point you will say, well, I don't have any actual direct immediate evidence that there are atoms. I just have this immediate evidence. There's evidence there are atoms, that's all. The immediate self-evidence just stops there. And then you can start to see, well, science is something that's inferred. Everything that science says about the deeper physical layer is inferred from this evidence. And once you've inferred something, you then make a prediction about what would happen if that were the case. And you run an experiment, and the experiment comes back, and there's some self-evidence back here in this world that says, oh, yes, what you inferred from this that predicted that actually happened. So do you just see the whole procedure of science is entirely starts in the life world, there's some reasoning and comes back to the life world. It never actually leaves the life world, because even the theories that you are holding in your mind are in the life world. Yes, they're in your experience. What the weird thing that's happening in science is that you are projecting your sense of actuality or reality, which we have given to us in immediate experience, into the theory. You're taking the sense of actuality or reality that is given to you immediately in experience, and you are projecting that actuality into the theory, into the entities that you, if you like, construct in your imagination that correspond to what the theory is predicting. So you do see mathematical forms in there. The theory, the mathematics, you can think of the mathematics as expressive of there being a certain form, like the form of an atom. But what happens is you project actuality. You give being to the atom. But the atom, its actual reality, is it's a theoretical construct. Do you see how easy we do it? The thing is, it's because we're projecting actuality into things we don't immediately experience all the time anyway. Just watch the news tonight, right? If you look at the news tonight, you're granting actuality to all of these situations in the earth, things that are going on in the earth, that you know nothing about. Almost our entire picture of the way the world is based on hearsay and stories in the media. So we're already completely imbued with believing in stuff that we don't actually verify through our immediate experience. That's why I think it would be very difficult to convince somebody from 2,000 or 3,000 years ago that anything like objective science could be true. Because the earlier cultures, one sense of reality would have been very strongly based on what's around you. Plus those, you've got to, of course there's all of those gods and spirits, which we won't go into now. One must bring to ultimate self-evidence how all the self-evidence of objective logical accomplishments through which objective theory is grounded has its hidden sources in the ultimately accomplishing life, the life in which the self-evident givenness of the life world forever has attained and attains anew its pre-scientific ontic meaning. Ontic meaning being. I'm hoping from all I've said now that that sentence makes sense.
If I live in if I'm a peasant and all my life I just lived in one farm with that, you know, and you tell me about like particles, and I ask you, do particles have wives and children?
What colour are they?
Yeah.
How big are they?
Yeah.
Because we do think like that, right? The thing about science is that it presents atoms and molecules as if they're like Albuquerque. They're actually there. You just haven't visited them yet. And it almost has a sense... But you could. All you need to do is become, like in a sci-fi movie, like this kind of... We put you in a shrinking machine. And you go... And then you'd be able to see the atoms and molecules. But you wouldn't. However small you were, you wouldn't see the atom or the molecule. All you'd know about is, if you went that small, is, oh my God, I've just been hit by a photon. You know, and I've disintegrated. Do you know what? All right. So the empiricist talk of natural scientists gives the impression that the natural sciences are based on the experience of objective nature. I don't know if you've got this, that science presents itself in a way, almost for historical reasons, saying, well, we actually base what we say on the fact, on the experience, on what really exists. Not like your religions. We don't base it on visions. To which I feel like I want to remind you that Galileo's idea of inertia was based entirely on his imagining what would happen if you took a body, a thing, a stone, out of all gravitational fields, away from the Earth, into an absolute vacuum, and you pushed it. And he envisaged it would just carry on moving at constant velocity forever. You know, that's Newton's first law of motion. utterly imagined. Nothing empirical about it. Right, the only... finally, it became empirical once we got out out of this space of gravity, but it was... utterly imagined. So in the early days of science, scientists were saying, mathematical science, they were saying stuff like this. We're basing what we say on actual experience, on empirical fact. And the Aristotelian scientists, who still had a different view of things, said, no, you're not. You utterly imagine that stuff about inertia. That's not based on experience. If I throw something, it always falls to the ground. The idea that science is entirely empirical is illusory. The fact is that it pays careful attention to the evidence of the senses.
It's reasoned.
Yeah. It is based on experimentation, but the verification that experimentation gives is the verification of our ordinary life world experience, which science, in a way, has appropriated, has claimed it for itself. So it's just playing a double game. It's like a politician. It's like saying, subjectivity, it's not reliable. What's reliable is what we say is real. But at the same time, surreptitiously, in the background, it's relying on what it calls subjectivity to provide it with all of its empirical evidence. However, when scientists think about what it is that they're really talking of, they do, they can start to recognize it as something metaphysically transcendent, in the sense that there are scientists who actually think that the universe in some way is a mathematical idea in a sort of a Platonic dimension. You know, Plato had the idea that there's a realm of pure ideas. And in fact, Roger Penrose is a mathematical physicist who is self-consciously Platonic. He thinks there's the physical, there's our conscious experience, and then there's the realm of the transcendental ideas. And that, in a way, mathematical physics is exploring that realm of the transcendental ideas that actually determine how the universe is. So that there's a lot of Platonism hidden in this form of scientific thinking. Because in a way, if you ask certain mathematical physicists what they think that they're studying, they think they're studying the Platonic realm. The pure ideas and laws that govern the universe, and that they somehow exist in their own right in a dimension that isn't physical or mental. I've got some sympathy with that. How you would actually ever be able to demonstrate it is another thing. The problem with a lot of philosophy, that thinks that way, is you say, it could be true, might be true, might not. If what distinguishes that from phenomenology is interested in what you can know and not speculating on what you can't know. This is something I was mentioning earlier, so I've already covered this. The experientiability of something objective is no different from that of an infinitely distant geometrical construct, and no different from that of all infinite ideas, such as the infinity of the number series. So the ideal of science is that it's continuously aiming towards this ultimate theory of everything, that is the perfect description of the entire universe. And when you have the ultimate theory of everything, I've mentioned this before, the ideal would be, so we know the mathematics, we now put that theory into a computer, and they press the button, and the computer will now unfold the entire story of the universe. It'll unfold the Big Bang, just as the Big Bang happened. It'll unfold the formation of the stars. It'll unfold the formation of the planets. It'll finally unfold the formation of life on Earth. It'll explain everything in terms of this ultimate mathematical ideal model. It's not even a model. It's an idea. And if you like, what physical science is doing is it knows that it can never finally reach the perfection of that, but it just gets closer and closer and closer and closer to it. So it's an infinite idea, and we have the same thing with the natural number series, although we might not be aware of it. Our idea of number has an infinity in it. Did I talk about this before? Yeah, I did, yeah. So although we can't think of infinity, we can think something like this. How many numbers are there in the natural number series? Well, let's think of the biggest one we can possibly think of. However big that number is, you can always add one to it. Yes? And however big that number is, you can always add one to it. So the infinite number series, the idea of it, kind of leapfrogs on the back of our idea of time. You see, we've got an idea of time that there's always a next moment. So there's always, like there's always a next moment, there's always a next number. Because we project time infinitely. And the number series is an expression almost of counting the moments of time. Yes. So, and mathematics as well, the mathematical physicists are also in their measurements trying to reach an infinite degree of precision that you can never reach. Except, I know I digress here, except if there is something quantum in the structure of the reality that science is investigating. Because if there's something quantum in it, it's almost like there'll be an absolute minimum distance that you can never truncate. If there were such a thing as an electron, it's not that the electron is there and then passes through a certain amount of space to be there. It's that it's there, and then it instantaneously becomes there. And there was no intervening electron moving in space. Do you see there's a possibility that space could be discrete in that way? That there's an ultimate, very, very tiny distance that we would measure and say that nothing can actually travel continuously. What really happens is that everything just goes from there to 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 there and jumps to different points. And time itself could be like that. That there's a minimum span of time, and if you like, something exists there, and then there's absolutely nothing, and then it exists there, slightly changed. And that there's a possibility that physics could come to actually empirically discover that the universe is absolutely discrete in that way. Because we've got an idea that time is continuous. The idea of time being continuous is that we could slice it up infinitely small. But we don't actually know that. Right? It's just an idea.
So there's no movement, there's transformation.
Yeah, there would be no movement in that universe. There'd just be a jumping from one state to another, like a movie frame, only there's there's trillions of such frames in a second, and then space is pixelated or voxelated. There are voxels, aren't there, in 3D space, so that you can only jump from one voxel to the next. There's never any continuity between it. We don't know if that's how fascinating it is in a way. We don't know the being of the physical, and whether it is discrete or continuous. Quite interesting, really. But I sense that that's a question that some future science, if we live long enough as a species, we'll come to have a final answer to. Who knows? So yes, This is important in our understanding of science. Rendering ideas intuitive in mathematical or natural scientific models is hardly an intuition of the objective. Right, this is where we fall into a sense that we could picture atoms and molecules. What we're really doing is we're using intuitions that from the life world to picture what the mathematical model might mean via a kind of a conceptual intermediary. And the example that Husserl uses is the idea of a geometrical space, straight line, right? When mathematicians think of space and shape and surfaces and forms and edges, an edge has no width. A straight line has no dimensions at all except length. That's what it means to think mathematically and geometrically, and that's the world in which mathematical science... That's the world that mathematical science proposes is the real world. You can't intuit a straight line in that sense. It has to have a width in order for it to be experientiable. But it's really just a perfection of a, you know, it's like, that's a straight line. It's like the infinite number series. A geometrical straight line is that straight line, only we just keep making it thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner, but we carry on doing that infinitely. And finally, at the very end of that infinite, like the end of the number series, it disappears, but it never quite disappears. It's always infinitely small. Calculus is like that as well. Calculus relies on thinking in those terms. Don't know if anyone's ever studied calculus. Yes? Calculus. No, because I am intrigued. Has anyone, apart from Michael, studied calculus? No. Calculus. Yeah, mathematical calculus. I'm only intrigued.
Like differentiation integration.
Yeah, differentiation and integration.
A level.
Yeah. I should have said differentiation and integration. Who studied differentiation and integration? Yes, but still a tiny minority of people now in the world will have covered that, I guess.
Well, A-level maths, obviously, there's a lot of people that do that.
Yes. Not many, though.
For example, what?
Well, I'm just taking this room as an example.
Don't people at school, though, do A-level maths quite commonly?
If you can remind us
a lot of people
about,
heard
like,
it.
What was
the... I guess I wonder how many people understand the infinitesimality of calculus, that it involves... The same process of dividing and dividing until something becomes infinitely small but doesn't disappear. Because when you differentiate... I'm sorry if you haven't done calculus, you ought to have done. When you want to work out the slope of a line, yes, you can work it out by saying, right, the slope of the line is the slope, you know, there's an actual angle there between those two points, but you want to know what the slope is exactly there, yes? And the way that calculus works is, okay, it doesn't work like this, but the way you think about it is you work out, you can only really work out the slope between two points, right? If you've got just a point, there's no possibility of working out a slope. The way calculus works is, okay, so we measure the slope by these two getting closer and closer and closer together. Yes? Until we get to a point where they're infinitesimally apart. And that then is the actual slope of the line. But of course, when they're infinitesimally apart, they're just a point.
Mm.
It's the same. So thinking in terms of calculus, or differentiation, which is how you get the slope of a line, it's the same as this example of thinking what a straight line is by shrinking something down. There's, it's the mathematics of limits, but I know we don't really want to learn that, but it's kind of already there in the background again of our immediate experience. It's in the infinity of time and the infinity of space that we somehow is already in us. A lot of mathematicians, and Kant thought this too, thought, ah, yes, actually our understanding of mathematics is already present. When you discover something's true mathematically, it's like a recognition of something that you already knew but didn't know you knew. Because that mathematical ideal world is sort of already there. And all the things that we can discover are really things that are already properties of the space that we already understand because we're already in that space. So let's go back. Was I on this page? I've forgotten where I was.
Yeah, you just went to the slide.
Yes, it's a new slide. Yes, as an accomplishment of scientific persons joined in the community of scientific activity, objective science belongs to the life world. Its theories are not things in the life world like stones, houses, or trees. They are logical wholes and parts made up of logical elements. They are ideal unities of signification. Now, what Husserl is hiding something here. You know that we were thinking about proofs and triangles and talking about geometry. Our ability to think of a triangle, an equilateral triangle, is an ability to think of a pure idea. I don't know, I feel like there's a space in which you can think of an equilateral triangle. You can draw it, and you know we can only approximate it by a drawing, but in our thought, in the dimension of our being able to think of things, we can think of an equilateral triangle, and you can think of one, I can think of one, and we're thinking of the same thing. And it has a kind of ideal existence. You know, it doesn't exist like the table, but it has there's an idea there, and both you and I can think of it. It has an ideal existence, which we can experience, right? We can't really picture it. You can't put your hands on it, but it's not nothing. And it's not something you've imagined. And it's not something subjective, because when you think of it and I think of it, then we are thinking of the same thing. So it has an objectivity, but the objectivity of a pure idea. Now, this ability for us to think of pure ideas is not just mathematical, right? We can think of New York. If we've never been to it, it's a kind of a pure idea. But and if you think of New York and I think of New York, we're thinking of the same thing, right? This capacity of thought to refer to things that aren't present and to refer to things that are pure ideas.
Intentionality.
It's intention. I haven't used the word intentionality yet because it's a technical word, and Husserl has not even mentioned it. I'm shocked that he hasn't even mentioned it yet. Yes, intentionality is Husserl's technical name for it. He means that we can intend something, and we can intend the same thing. And in that way, the thing that we intend has a kind of an existence that's independent of your subjectivity. So there is... This is the Platonic realm, if you like. Mm. Now, the Platonic realm is just a part of the life world. Is it? The life world isn't just your ability to experience physical objects. It's your ability to refer to things in thought. And if you remember, I don't know if we've been through it, but even your idea of the cup is a kind of ideality. Even though the cup's right in front of you now, you only see the aspect that the cup's showing you. You've got an idea of the cup. I can't see its handle, right? But my idea of the cup is that it's got a handle. I can't see the bottom, but my idea of the cup is it's got a bottom. I can't see the white quality of the china if I were to smash it. And yet my idea of the cup includes the inside of the china as it would look if I smashed it. My idea of the cup even includes the idea that there's something like atoms and molecules in it. And the chemical constituents. Do you see? Actually, when I refer to the cup, I mean all of that. And it's a kind of an idea that lies behind my immediate experience of the cup. I have an idea of its form, of what it's made of its temperature. Do you see? So all the time, the life world is shot through with ideas that we have of things.
It seems different though, the cup versus the equilateral triangle, because obviously the triangle never existed.
Yes.
The cup did exist.
Yes. There are some ideas that we can have a self-evident perception of their actuality. Yes? And not only that, in a way, the thing about the cup is that it actually can inform me and change my idea of it.
Of what a cup is?
Yes. So it exists in time and it can be shattered and somebody made it. It came into being, it goes out of being. It's got a whole temporality of being out here my idea of the triangle is not temporal. It wasn't made and it's not going to be destroyed. Do you know, it exists in a... the idea we have of the cup is a very different idea to the idea of the triangle, but they're still ideas. They've got something in common.
Are we talking about the definite art or cup?
I'm talking about this cup. Although you're right, in the background there's the idea of cup in general.
Yeah.
And once you get to the idea of cup in general, you're getting close to the idea of a triangle, right? Because you can never meet cup in general.
Mm.
It's like a triangle. The triangle's attributes are 60 degrees, the equilateral, or equal sides, and the attribute of cup is different. The thing about the idea of cup, which means it's not mathematical, is it's an abstraction from experience. Whereas the idea of a triangle is a construction. So we have a perfect idea of a triangle. We have an imperfect and slightly ambiguous idea of cup. We're not sure if a cup has to have a handle. You see, if I smash the handle off that, still be a cup? Yeah. I think so, yeah. Has it got to be able to be drinkable, outable?
Yeah,
but is a stone with a dip in it a cup? No, it seems to have a lip. But you know, it's all a bit... It's not got the... Whereas my idea of a triangle is absolutely unambiguous. And when it becomes absolutely unambiguous like that, it becomes mathematical. Another sign of the mathematical is its utter precision.
Yeah.
So its theories are not... things in the life world like stones or houses, they are ideal unities of signification, which means that they're meanings in themselves. They're like pure meaning configurations that don't they don't exist out here, and they're not something like a definite thing upon which I've generated some kind of idea. They're kind of... you could say that shapes have been abstracted from experience, but once they become geometric shapes, there's a point where they've been severed, and they become pure idealities in themselves, and they no longer require experience, even though it was on the basis of experience that we first developed our ideas of there being straight lines and triangles, on the basis of surveying and measuring. You know, the practical arts became pure mathematics. There's a point where pure mathematics became perfected ideas. And these ideal unities of signification, what Husserl wants to say, they're part of the life world. Yes, they're just another capacity that we have, along with our capacity to perceive objects in their actuality. And their logical ideality means that once you've got a mathematical representation of something, because it's utterly perfect, utterly precise, you can make utterly certain deductions. Like, you can do proofs. Once you've got something in an ideal form, in an ideal mathematical form, then you can say, with absolute necessity, this will follow. With absolute necessity, it follows that every triangle has 180, the angles add up to 180 degrees in Euclidean space, purely on the properties of the properties of the triangle that in fact you were in charge of in the first place. Yes. You know, because it's a world that you've made that world, you've defined it in its perfection, and once you've defined a world in its perfection, it becomes a mathematical world, and then you can make deductions on it. Whereas out here in the empirical world, you can only do inductions. You can say, up until now, it's worked this way. And do you see one of the things that science intends to do is to create an ideal mathematical representation of the world so that it can then do deductions. Because you can't do deductions from experience. There's no logic, you can't deduce with absolute logical certainty that if I drop that cup, it'll smash on the floor. All you can say is, up until now. So there's quite a... Do you see the deduction, really, with absolute logical certainty, is something that can only belongs to the sphere of the mathematical. And that's part of the reason why science has transposed our immediate experience into an idealized mathematical world, so that it can perform deductions with absolute necessity. And when it's performed its deductions, once again, we call them predictions. If the predictions turn out to be the case, that if you put enough uranium together in the right way, and you put some kind of charge in that great mass of uranium, that there'll be a fission nuclear reaction. That was, you know, you deduced all of that from the properties of matter, and then the bomb goes off. You get some kind of evidence that the model was correct, but model is even the wrong word. It's a theory. A pure, exact, perfect mathematical theory. Do you get any idea of the two worlds? Huh? And yet the theory, always got to get it the right way around. The theory is in the mind of you or I, but it's not subjective either, right? Because of the things that the theory thinks of are like triangles and numbers. So they're objective in their way. Yeah. So, here we enter into an uncomfortable situation. We have two different things, life world and objective scientific world. The knowledge of the objective scientific world is grounded in the self-evidence of the life world. The latter is pre-given as ground, yet as they build upon this, what is built is something new and something different. We scientists are, after all, human beings, and as such are among the components of the life world, which always exists for us, ever pre-given, and thus all of science is pulled along with us into the life world. And what becomes of the objective world itself? What happens to the hypothesis of being in itself? Related first to the things of the life world, the objects, the real bodies, real animals, plants, and also human beings, within space-time, quotes, of the life world. All these concepts being understood now not from the point of view of objective sciences, but as they are in the pre-scientific life. Now he's just, and I think for the next few slides, he's going to just be just throwing this on the table, right? So what are we to make of this? Because it's not a lie. Right, this atomic, molecular, quantum physical, photonic theory of evolution, cause and effect, underlying mathematical structure of the world, right? This underlying mathematical structure of the world that objective science, purely through diligent measurement, has uncovered, it's not been imagined either. At one point you can say it's occurred within the life world, and yet at the same time it's purporting to explain the very world, that very world. How do we hold this together, right? Because previous in history we had no such problem, right? The life world is the life world, and our problem was more to do with the psyche and what was going on in it. But now science has come along and says, no, this is the real world. Do you see the... You've got to kind of feel that it's not as if you can just say that's false. That, you know, science is false, the world as we experience it, this is the true world.
And if you solve this problem, you solve the crisis.
Yes, you do. You solve the crisis of the European sciences, exactamundo. But first, you've got to feel it, right? In a way, you've got to feel it. In a way, it bites. Then, philosophically, if you feel it in such a way as you say, "Well, I don't know how to respond," you know, then if you confront something like this that actually bites, you say, "Oh gosh, this is me, right? This is how it is in me." That's when philosophy bites, and you say, "And I don't know." Now, either you can live in "I don't know," or you can say, "Well, is there some way that I can bring this?" Because it's a problem that's laid in our laps, just by means of us living in this world. Because this is a description in a certain philosophical language of our actual situation. You know, and I feel like there's a philosophical gauntlet. I want to throw it on the table. I'm saying, well, are you just happy to sort of be perplexed? Is that be perplexed and just carry on? Sort of, because in a way, a lot of people, especially at university, they live like this, right? Here I'm scientific today. I'm doing my science. I'm writing my papers. I'll even argue with you about it. Then I'm back home. I'm eating my dinner, and I'm back in the life world with my kids and my family. And the two do not, they don't meet, right? They contradict each other. When you're...
They do. Isn't that what we're saying?
Ah, well, yes, that is what we're saying. They do, but are we there yet?
But then this distinction does not even exist, right? Like, there's no... We cannot talk about a distinction between two worlds because the scientific world exists or stems from the...
The life world,
yes.
Yes. Well, if you just stay in the life world, you've still got to say, well, in what way do I understand my being conscious? Science here has discovered that. There are these structures, these physical structures that make up my brain and all the rest of the universe, and they behave together in extremely lawful ways, extremely lawful and predictable ways. Now, that seems to be true. We don't have a direct experience of it, but that doesn't mean it's not true. But that can give no account whatsoever of our being conscious. So, if it's true, there seems to be something wrong with it as well, right? Because if you go into that world, it can't give an account of the life world. Do you see? We need to be in a place in 2019 where we can give an account of what our science means, not that it's kind of wrong. But what does it mean? What does it mean? What is it? Because it's told us, in a way, you see, at a certain level, it's extraordinary what we've discovered about the universe compared to 300-400 years ago, and what we've unlocked. And I need to point to the technology? I mean, we might feel bad about the state of the world, but we wouldn't. Get in the car, get in the bus, catch the train home, turn the heating on, turn the electric light on. We're not going around with a candle. It's all around. It works. It functions. What account? And yet, its understanding of us is that we're kind of robotic automatons. I'm making you into me, really, because this was me at the university. So what's your response to all your colleagues, right? I'm sitting here in the university, and I've got a bunch of colleagues who say, yes, John, it's hard to accept, but that's it. We're just robotic automatons. So here, what's your answer to that? Is it biting at all? Because in a way, our whole civilization doesn't answer this. It just sort of looks to one side, and Nicolette says something, well, it's terrible, the computer's going to take over. And we say, oh, that is terrible. Well, I've got to go on with my life, you know. We're a whole civilization that's living with this kind of incoherence between our scientific understanding of things and our everyday understanding. And we just pottle along, you know. I mean, we may not be Christians, but one thing I would say for Christianity is that it was coherent. It had a unified story about what we're doing here, why we're here, how we got here, where we're going. It had a whole overarching myth.
They lived and fought for something.
Yeah.
Today's politics, is there any kind of purpose? It's just, I don't know.
Well, I've been looking into it. Our purpose now, if you look below the surface, is at some level we've accepted that we're robotic automata, and the most important thing for us as robotic automata formed by evolution is for us to live as long and as comfortably as we possibly can, expect the same thing for our children. If you're an entirely physical organism, all you really come to care about is your physical well-being. And I think and that includes the well-being of my brain, that I'm not depressed, that I'm reasonably happy, that I stay in a certain state of mental equilibrium, physical equilibrium, enough food. Our entire sort of trajectory in life is about that. It's about making the robot comfortable, isn't it?
Not our entire, but
I'm talking about the Conservative government. Yeah. I'm talking about the election now. We've got to keep the robot comfortable, and it's not very uncomfortable in the NHS. Yeah, we've got to keep the robot comfortable. It's not very comfortable for the people on the streets, right? We have a sense of justice, and you might say, "Oh, well, that's not robotic." It's robotic. We want justice because if we don't have some form of justice, then we live in discord and disharmony, and it's unpleasant for us.
But also, we would project that that could happen to us tomorrow or next minute. We want that security.
Yes. But and then the evolutionary biologists come along and say, of course, you've got a certain amount of concern for the species that evolution put in you as the robot you are.
There's even apes have order. They have troops, boats have them, hierarchy.
Yeah.
And the form.
Yes.
And they're not as distinct as they can.
Well, it's...
This is just a bigger...
Yeah.
A bigger tribe.
Yes.
About.
Exactly. We're a bigger tribe of apes who've got more neocortex. And having more neocortex means that we can project ourselves a bit further into the future. This is the view that science has of us. Because I'm still sort of answering you about we are confronted with a problem here, with a this split between the two worlds isn't just something that Husserl's making up. It's actually in our civilization. If we look into it, but mostly we don't, right? Because mostly we're just watching Strictly on a Saturday night. Don't miss it. No, sorry. But you don't. Nobody was Strictly here. Can't, I'm quite right.
So, what would a unified world look like?
Well,
it's a good question.
What would a unified? What you can? And this is, I think, Marguerite's point in a way. A unified world looks like the world looks when you stop thinking. Mm. See, it's not so very far away. You just. The entire scientific world only actually arises when you pull back and you reflect. If you stop pulling back and you don't reflect, then you move back into a world where there's no scientific independent physical reality underlying this reality. The real split is between subjectivity and objectivity. And if you come back to this immediate moment, I'm subjectively present here in an objective world. So that the unity, there is a unity in experience. The disunity comes in our thinking of it. And in a way, if you want to know what philosophy is, one level of what philosophy is a cure for our thinking, because we're already okay if we don't think, yeah. But when we do think, we get into trouble. We get into something like what I call the labyrinth. Yeah, we get lost. And we get lost because our culture has got lost.
Knowledge is power, and ignorance is bliss.
But there's a third line here. There's three here, right? There's ignorance being present, which isn't really ignorance, but it's a kind of ignorance. And there's knowledge. There's knowledge is power when you have a true understanding, a true conscious understanding. But there's a middle state where you're neither ignorant but all your knowledge is false. that's sort of where we are, right? Where just about all of our knowledge is tainted with a kind of a false background understanding. So we're not exactly ignorant, but we don't have true knowledge either. We're in an in-between kind of world. I mean, I know I don't have to show you these slides because you all read the reading in such detail that it's burnt on your mind, isn't it? Because you're all looking at it as if it's the first time you've ever seen it. But I'm sure that's not the case. Because in a way, we've covered an awful lot of the lecture, so I want to kind of spin through these slides now. So we know that the concrete life world is the grounding soil, and that it's all encompassing, right? We've got that sense that it's the grounding soil of all possible verifications. It's all encompassing, so we don't leave the life world when we think. So this objective scientific understanding of the world is kind of something that's grown up within the life world, but in itself, from that place, it's in some sense you often find this, we almost feel this. It's like an objective scientist speaks and thinks as if he or she is not in the life world anymore. That they, Thomas Nagel called it the view from nowhere. Especially if you're a mathematician, you abstract yourself so high up in thought that you feel that you're no longer in the life world. You're in some kind of godlike mathematical ideal universe. And you're able to look back down on everything like God would, and there you see the life world in all its kind of illusoriness, because you're up there in your mathematical Platonic region. And what Husserl is saying is, no, you never left the life world, right? You're still sitting on the chair, you know, your heart's still beating, the traffic's still going by, you're imagining that. But even if we accept that, we still have to give an account for what this means, this capacity, this... at a certain level, it's a miraculous thing, right? That the apes... Remember the apes? The troop of apes, right? Not long ago, we were up the trees, right? Now, the apes made this, right? How did they, it wasn't that we went up in our minds and started imagining triangles, right? It came back and it's changed the world. And not only has it changed the world, it's almost determining, every moment of the day, we're more or less interacting with the very technology that science has produced. And even now we've spent 4 hours talking about it. Looking at a screen with a computer projecting the world. Do you know we're not out in the trees, are we? Remember, this is a kind of a softening up of the ground. Do you see what does it mean? How can we incorporate this scientific understanding that is obviously of value? How do we incorporate it back into our life world so that it isn't some... Because at the moment, it's creating a kind of... nihilistic meaninglessness to our sense of why we're here on Earth. And all Husserl's saying here is, well, the fact that science has got a different idea of what the true world is doesn't mean that that's the true world, but the fact that in our ordinary experience we feel that this is the true world, science does throw that into question. What it does in phenomenology, and this is the kind of next level of it, is it throws into question, and this is, Heidegger went into this, what do we mean by a true world anyway? because in a way, you know, we have a kind of oppositional thinking. We're thinking, well, maybe the scientific world's true. Oh no, so that means this experience that we're having now, that's the true world. At this sort of point or juncture, Husserl's trying to say, well, what do we mean by the true world? He's about to say something along the lines of, our very idea of there being a true world is a kind of an idea. You know, to begin with, and he's about to, in the epoche, he's about to say, well, we've got this deep-seated sense that this is the true actuality is given by our perceptual experience. We're not really going to be able to get to the bottom of this until we suspend that as well. Doesn't mean we say it's not true. You know, we're seeking after a softening up to the point where we arrive at a recognition that we don't really know what we're talking about. That's what he means. That we shall suddenly become aware that all of our philosophizing up to now has been without a ground, because we haven't really thought about what we mean by being in the first place. What does it mean for something to be? What does it mean for a world to be the true world? We're just arriving on the edges of transcendental subjectivity, right? Because there's something in transcendental subjectivity that is granting actuality. And you can see it in the scientists, right? The scientists, or if you absolutely absorb yourself in a scientific worldview, that power of granting actuality, you start to use it to grant your scientific theory the status of actuality. I mean, Husserl, I'm jumping ahead. He's wanting to hold up a mirror and say, do you see this power that's emanating from you that's granting actuality? You catch it when you have an illusion. When something is illusory, you say, oh, I thought it was real. Yeah. In order to do phenomenology, we've got to step back and not say, oh, I'm betting on that horse, I'm betting on that horse. It's a matter of stepping back and saying, well, what is this actuality? You know, what's the power behind it? All right, quick summary here. Husserl's, he's saying, right, what we need is something like phenomenology, which is, we need to investigate the life world, the pre-given world. We need to get to the bottom of what that is. But how are we going to do that? We can't do it objectively, right? It's the very objectivity of science that has caused us to be in this problematic state in the first place. So we're not going to be able to abstract ourselves from it and treat our subjective experience as if it was some kind of object. Psychology's already done that. And neither are we going to be able to apply a kind of a mathematical, logical reasoning to it, because we don't even know, we don't really even understand where our logic comes from. I mean, one of the things that Husserl does and is likely to do is to say, even we don't really even understand mathematics. We don't understand logic. We've got no real method. We need a new science, he's saying, the science of that's going to uncover to us the life world as it is, not as some kind of objectified, preconceived idea that science has of it. We want to encounter the life world as it is and discover what it is. And we've no idea, phrase, absolute beginners. He loves to use this. We've no idea how to do it because it's never been done before. we know that the methods that we use in ordinary science aren't going to work. And yet, if we don't have an account of the life world, because all of science comes out of the life world and is verified by the life world, we don't really have a proper science. Quantum science still doesn't see the life world. Quantum science, in a way, has punctured the objectivity of science. It's gone so far that it's put a hole in it. But it, in a way, where physics stands at the moment, it's looking at the hole and saying, well, what does that mean? You know, and it's still the way of thinking of quantum physics has still come out of the life world and is objective, scientifically, mathematically objective. Husserl is saying, well, we can't. You've reached the edge of what you can think in quantum physics, but you've got to come back now and understand science as something that's grown out of the life world. If you can understand how science has grown out of the life world, then maybe we can understand science and maybe we can enfold it back. You know, we can make it something that in some sense is no longer separated or abstracted or in some conflict with the life world. But he wants to say, but that's a dream, right? At the moment, we don't even know how to encounter it, how to reveal it. But that's, yes.
Did that experiment with the beams hitting the, and when you look at the atoms, it affects how
the split, the
photons.
Yeah, yeah.
Go through the slits and
the dual slit experiment.
Yeah.
With the electrons.
That's right.
Yeah.
And when you look at the atoms, it affects.
Yeah. If you measure them, they turn into particles. If you don't measure them, they remain like waves.
Yes,
it's the wave-particle duality. That's what I mean by there's a hole at the end of physics, because you can no longer identify objective things anymore. It all breaks down. But that doesn't answer our question. All right, really fast. The way that science approaches understanding anything is to think with absolute logical clarity. And to think logically is to think, in a way, mathematically, which means you have to bring your language that we ordinarily use. It almost becomes like a computer language. You have to use terms that are utterly unambiguous, which means I'm using a word and it refers to this and exactly this. And typically the only way you can do that is to use a word to refer to something that is ultimately identifiable in the physical world. So we can develop formal languages to talk about physical stuff, because we can say the word cup in this respect, it refers to. And science, of course, gets further down and says the word electron refers to. And every term you use in a logical language has a unique referral. There's no ambiguity whatsoever in it. And it's another reason why science looks back on us, the poor humans, not just as in a kind of a subjective illusion, but using natural language is a kind of a sad subjective state to be in, because we, to a large extent, are quite unclear about what our words refer to. And they love to take philosophers on for this, because, of course, we're using words here where it's utterly unclear what they might mean. And it's probably quite likely, if I went and interviewed everyone after this class, that I would discover that there's an extraordinary range of meanings that each one of us have for the words that I've been using, despite the fact that I think you mean what I mean, but you think that I mean what you mean. Do you know we're in that And science says, no, we've got to have a formal language. The formal language is logic. And the only kind of way we can progress is to progress in terms of thinking in formal languages. And science has progressed that way. Husserl is saying, well, we can't do that. Because formal language objectifies everything, and we want to talk about the life world. The life world, if we objectify it, we destroy it. So we don't even know what language we can use to speak of our experience of intuition. And he's going to say, we're going to have to develop our own language and our own logic specifically to speak of this dimension.
How to communicate this dimension.
Yes. But even the terms we're going to use, like intentionality, which I haven't brought up because it's such a job, right, to be able to distinguish what the words mean when we're referring to our immediate experience. All right, we're nearly there. I'm glad you've got a few minutes. The first thing he wants to do, the obvious thing, is we have to stop thinking scientifically. That doesn't mean we deny it, but we suspend it. We're not saying science is false, but the entire understanding that we have of our experience being something generated in our brains, our entire neuroscientific, even the idea that we have got brains, we have to just say, all right, let's just hold that for the moment. Because as far as the life world is concerned, we have to stick with what's in the life world. And there are no neurons, there are no atoms, there are no photons. All of the substruction of science does not appear directly in our immediate experience. So we're going to stop thinking of the things in our immediate experience in scientific terms, but not that we're saying it's false. We're just saying, I'm going to abstain from such cognitions. And this is the first and the easiest part of the epoche of the what he also called the phenomenological reduction. It's the bracketing of science. But I hope you've got, the point of this class really, is that you've got an idea of how far the tendrils of science have reached into our understanding. It's not just a simple thing. You can't suspend your scientific thinking until you recognise what it is and how it's working in you. And then he's talking there about having some vocational time where you deliberately enter into this state. But it's going to be a state where you look into experience. We're not there yet. This is just stage one. And then there's an inspiring statement. So this vocational attitude of the epoche by no means implies that the life world epoche means no more for human existence, practically and existentially, than the vocational epoche of the cobbler. To which I might say, you know, if there was a cobbler present, they might, you know, that I'm not sure he's being fair to the cobbler here. There may be something deep in, if you're really totally a cobbler, but let's not go into that. Or that it is a matter of indifference whether one is a cobbler or a phenomenologist, or whether one is a phenomenologist or a positive scientist. I mean, what he's saying is, to jump ahead, is that the epoche is a matter of withdrawing your intelligence back into a place of union with the transcendental subjectivity that is producing this very experience. The epoches are, in a way, ways of withdrawing back. But part of the way of withdrawing back is just to read what Husserl is saying. You know, we're enacting this by our very contemplation of the situation that we're in. Do you see that? That in itself is part of the of the bracketing of our ordinary way of thinking. This is looking ahead. Perhaps it will, when we've finished this, so this is like a promissory note, even become manifest that the total phenomenological attitude and the epoche belonging to it are destined in essence to effect at first a complete personal transformation comparable in the beginning to a religious conversion, which then, over and above this, bears within itself the significance of the greatest existential transformation which is assigned as a task to mankind as such. Now, right, dying minutes. He's either got kind of a grandiosity about him, right here. There's a certain grandiosity coming across, or at a certain level, what he's proposing, I think, is that it's almost that after the Middle Ages, we entered into a scientific consciousness to some degree or other, and everyone's into it in different degrees or other. He's saying that what he's talking about in the epoche is the next level of consciousness, if you like. The one that we, if we want to get out of our current difficulties, the only way out is to come to an understanding of science and of our own consciousness, and that requires us almost an evolution of our consciousness, and that evolution of consciousness is what he intends in this epoche. The total transformation is the beginnings of another dimension or level of consciousness that is, he's saying, and this is for humanity as a task, maybe a task that's going to take centuries. Right? He's not talking about it's just going to happen in, you read his book and it's all over. Yes.
Yeah, but what would you do, rather than ask how is it and what is it, what would you do with it? What would you do if you know where consciousness came from?
What would you do with it?
Yeah,
well, that's a bit, I mean, I feel like Heidegger's, I remember Heidegger saying a similar thing. In a way, you're not going to do anything with it. It's going to be, I would say the consequence of it would be we would stop living the way that we're living now. It would be a kind of a
recipe for sanity.
It would be a pulling back from the trajectory that we're on. It doesn't specify some kind of new trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
It just specifies a pulling back from a certain understanding that we have. And if we pull back from that understanding, then our very motivation to carry on as the way that we're carrying on will also disappear. And as that disappears, we'll have to, you know, as the human beings that we are, we're going to have to sort of stop and say, well, where do we go from here? So it's not really a doing, it's a negating.
But at what point a new way of being would come forth from that?
Yes.
You know, by its own, it won't be something we can think of. It will just come forth.
Yes.
If you have an obsessive compulsive disorder, and if that goes away, you come to your senses.
Yes.
You can, from then you can continue to whatever you want to do without being.
Well, and that's another way of looking at it. One way of looking at it is what Husserl is proposing is a kind of a cure for a certain kind of mental illness that we're currently suffering from. We don't think of it as a mental illness, of course, because when everyone's got it, it's not thought of like that. But I think from a future humanity, they would look back on us and say, all right, I think we've done it. I'm glad everyone could manage the extra quarter of an hour.